Why didn't Lutherans abandon many of the worship practices of the medieval Roman Catholic Church? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Faith and Act, the Survival of Medieval Ceremonies in the Lutheran Reformation. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or you can find out more about Faith and Act at issuesetc.org. Faith and Act, the Survival of Medieval Ceremonies in the Lutheran Reformation. The 16th century reformer Martin Luther called him this good, pious, holy martyr, Saint Robertus, referring to Robert Barnes, considered to be among the first of the Lutheran martyrs. We'll be talking about him here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome to the program on this Monday afternoon. It's the 30th of July. We're coming to you live. Thanks for tuning us in. A little bit later, Deaconess Pam Nielsen joins us. We're going to be talking about Dorcas the Mercy Worker. That's Acts chapter 9, teaching a Sunday school lesson there. Then in the second hour of the program, I'm really looking forward to this conversation because one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite hymns of all time, Abide With Me. It's an evening hymn. It's a funeral hymn. It is a life hymn. It is a Lord's Supper hymn. It is a baptism hymn. It is a lot of very good him, and Dr. Arthur Just will be our guest in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. on this Monday afternoon to study that hymn for the entire hour, Abide With Me with Dr. Arthur Just. Joining us to talk about 16th century confessor and martyr Robert Barnes, a name you might not have heard of, but after this half hour, hopefully you'll know him much better, and his bold confession of the true faith. Dr. Corey Moss, Associate Professor of Theology and Church History at Concordia University, California. Dr. Moss, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me on.
Before we meet this confessor and martyr, why was Robert Barnes killed and by whom?
Well, that's a very good question, actually, and the answer, I suppose, partly depends on whom you ask. Henry VIII, who is certainly involved, probably would have said that Barnes was burned simply because he was a troublemaker, and there's certainly something to that. Most specifically, he was a troublemaker because he would not stop talking publicly about the doctrine of justification by grace alone through faith alone, and that was something that was being increasingly forbidden as a public debating point in the England of Henry VIII at the time.
We need to remember, just in terms of its historical setting, this is before the Reformation proper came to the Church of England. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that also kind of depends on who you ask and how they define the term Reformation. Already at this point, the king had officially broken with the Church of Rome, renounced his recognition of the papacy as being necessary or the head of the church. In its place, he declared himself the head of the Church of England. But the way some people often describe the early English church in the 16th century is Catholicism without the Pope. Now, that's got a lot of problems with it, but it's true at least in this respect. Henry was very much a fan of traditional Catholic dogma, but he was not a particular fan of the papacy. And so he broke with the Pope and tried to retain the Catholic dogma, which Barnes himself was not entirely impressed with.
What was the connection between Robert Barnes and Martin Luther?
They have a number of connections. There's good evidence that Barnes, while he's still living in England, prior at the Augustinian Friary in Cambridge, is aware of Luther, aware of the Reformation beginning in Germany. There is also some evidence that he is distributing illegally in England copies of William Tyndale's translation of the New Testament, which is greatly dependent upon Luther's own translation of the New Testament. But their first personal contact comes as a result of a sermon that Barnes preached at the end of 1525. And one of Barnes' earliest biographers makes note of the fact that Barnes apparently plagiarized large chunks of this sermon from one of Luther's own sermons. And a controversy ensues. Barnes is arrested, tried, and eventually imprisoned. towards the end of 1528, he manages to escape imprisonment and flees immediately to the continent. And the next we hear of him, he's actually in Wittenberg, living with Luther's pastor, Johannes Bugenhagen, and enrolling as a student at the University of Wittenberg.
So you've kind of begun to already, but tell us the rest of his story.
Well, from his place in Wittenberg, he becomes more acquainted with the particulars of Lutheran theology. While he's living with Bugenhagen, he begins a little, I suppose you might call it a commonplace booklet. It's almost in the format of something like Philip Melanchthon's Loci Communes. It's a series of doctrinal propositions. So one is justified by grace through faith alone. And then under that title, he lists the various biblical passages that support that, various quotations from the Church Fathers, even from medieval authorities. And he does this, and he publishes it originally in Latin, and it's quite obviously a defense of Lutheran theology. When it's learned later by Henry VIII and some of his advisors in England that this Englishman is close to the Lutheran reformers, when Henry begins searching about for people to support the annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, he thinks that this Englishman who is close to Luther might be a good liaison to the University of Wittenberg, and quite possibly he could convince the University of Wittenberg to announce in favor of this annulment. And so Barnes is called back to England. He's given this assignment. The fact that he is a fugitive, an escaped prisoner, is forgotten. And so he becomes, starting in 1531, a kind of back-and-forth liaison between Henry VIII, Luther, and the German princes.
Did Henry ever get what he wanted out of the Lutheran theologians?
No, to his great chagrin. Wittenberg was, if not the only, one of the very few universities that did not come out in support of the annulment of Henry's marriage. And yeah, Henry never really forgets this. He's grousing about it even long after the marriage has been annulled. He's remarried, and his ex-wife has died. And the negotiations continue because other things are afoot, and the Lutheran Schmalkaldic League, organized for the possible defense of the Lutheran territories in the event of the Emperor Charles V invading, looks kind of attractive to Henry. He would kind of like to be a part of that, having some fear that he might be on the receiving end of an imperial invasion. And so he's pretty consistently involved with negotiations to try to become a part of this alliance. The Lutherans are quite insistent, though, that this is an alliance built on the defense of the gospel, and so if we don't have agreement on the gospel, on what we're actually defending, then we can't throw in together.
How does Robert Barnes fall out of Henry VIII's favor?
Well, he's never terribly in Henry's favor. It appears quite obvious that Henry finds him useful. He never particularly cares for him. But he keeps him around not only because he's useful, but also because Barnes is one of the favorites of two of Henry's closest advisors. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, is patron of Barnes. And Thomas Cromwell, technical term, the vicegerent in spirituals. He's the sort of vice president beneath Henry himself of the Church of England. He's also a great patron of Barnes. And so as long as they're in favor, Barnes remains tentatively in favor, or at least protected. He really finally falls out, and this leads immediately to his execution, when Cromwell falls out. Cromwell usually played his cards pretty close to his vest, but it is discovered that he has been working behind the king's back to negotiate a theological agreement with the German Lutherans. Henry feels betrayed, Cromwell is arrested, and Cromwell himself is executed only 2 days before Barnes is.
So this is as typical, really even today, this is a mixture, kind of a perfect storm of the political, in Henry's case, something of the personal, and the theological all going on at once.
It really is. And, you know, Barnes has often been accused, perhaps rightly, of not knowing when to stop or not knowing how to be political in the generic sense of the term. He's very fiery. He's very cantankerous, and he's very faithful. And so he often tends not to consider the political consequences of his speech or his actions, while Henry and many of his advisors were very keen to pay attention to that sort of thing.
Was Oliver Cromwell kind of his patron, his protector, for the time that he was kind of under Henry's thumb for a bit? Was Oliver Cromwell, in attempting to work out behind Henry's back this agreement with the German theologians, was he hoping to bring Lutheran-style Reformation to the Church of England?
Yes, Thomas Cromwell.
Thomas, sorry.
He really was. And Cromwell's a bit of an enigma. I mean, like I said, he plays things close to his vest, and he's most well known, I suppose, in the popular imagination as a politician with no real theological commitments. But that picture of him has been changing, and he does in fact seem to have been very much in favor of a Lutheran style Reformation. Seems to have been not only a believer in justification by grace through faith alone, but also a proponent of a real presence, though not necessarily a transubstantiationary presence in the Lord's Supper. Now, having said that, he is a politician, if not only a politician, so he also sees some of the political benefits of an alliance with the German territories. But he really does seem to have wanted, along with Barnes, a Reformation along distinctly Lutheran lines in England.
Let's take a break. When we come back on this Monday, July the 30th, we'll talk more about 16th century confessor and martyr Robert Barnes. Dr. Corey Moss is our guest. When we come back, what kind of message, political, theological, was Henry VIII trying to send by executing Robert Barnes? Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Pastor Dan Kistler of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Pacifica, California. A small congregation on the Pacific Coast just south of San Francisco, we invite you to join us as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation that He won for us on the cross and now delivers to us through His Word, baptism, and the Lord's Supper. For more information about us or for free downloadable sermons, visit our website at oursaviorspacifica.com. God's peace be with you always in our Savior, Jesus Christ.
We have a special premium for first-time donors to Issues Etc. It's the new Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio mousepad. We'll send it to you for your first-time donation to Issues Etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make your first-time gift by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Over summer, 2.5 months of what a child learned in school can leak away. Call Sylvan to turn summer learning loss into a gain. Sylvan pinpoints exactly what skills your child needs in just 3 hours a week over 12 weeks. You'll see results in your child's math or reading performance improving one grade level guaranteed. Demonstrated through the pre and post assessment. So call now. At participating locations only. Some restrictions may apply. Call for complete guarantee details.
Sylvan Learning Center of Shiloh, 618-628-0018, 628-0018.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Huddersfield Choral Society with the hymn Abide With Me, one of my favorites. So many of my favorites. Play 24/7, 365 days a year at LutheranPublicRadio.org. It's sacred music for the world, the church's music, according to the church's year. You can listen to it anytime at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Currently playing music for the Pentecost season. By the way, we will be studying that hymn, one of my favorites there, Abide With Me, that you didn't get to see if you were in the U.S., that part of the Olympic opening ceremony that was not broadcast, where a Scottish singer sang this beautiful hymn in its entirety, including that pivotal final stanza, Hold Thou Thy Cross Before My Closing Eyes, for a worldwide audience. We'll be studying that hymn with Dr. Arthur Just of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in Hour 2 of Issues, etc., on this Monday afternoon. In the meantime, Dr. Corey Moss is our guest. We're talking about 16th century confessor and martyr Robert Barnes. He was burned at the stake by Henry VIII on this day in 1540. Dr. Moss, what kind of message was Henry, political, theological, what kind of message was the king trying to send by executing Robert Barnes?
It's both a political message and a theological message. And this comes back to the question of why was he executed? And the flippant answer, it depends who you ask, isn't entirely flippant, because we're never told. This is a curious thing about Barnes' execution, is that he's condemned by act of attainder, which simply means he's declared guilty, but we're never told guilty of what. Was it treason? Was it heresy? Was it something else? And I think that that is left intentionally ambiguous. Certainly, much is made of his theology, but at the same time, much is made of his potentially treasonous behavior, or at least illegal behavior. Because after 1539, when Parliament passes the Act of Six Articles, certain points of doctrinal controversy are simply deemed not open for discussion. So by the very fact of publicly discussing theology, you are falling afoul of the political authorities.
So he is never officially branded a heretic?
He's never officially branded a heretic, no. There are lots of accusations, but none of them go into the official record. That's right.
I guess this is kind of a speculative question for an historian, but I wonder what Henry would have thought if it would have been suggested to him that he was actually doing the Pope's dirty work for him.
It's hard to know what Henry would have thought. There is a great debate continuing even to this day about, frankly, how much Henry thought. You know, was his break with the Pope, was his retention of Catholic doctrine, how much of any of this was his own doing based on his own firm convictions, and how much of it was the doing of different factions in his court? And there is a lot of back and forth between factions at his court. So who knows what Henry would have responded to something like that.
How does Luther react to the execution of Robert Barnes?
As you might expect, Luther would react. He explodes with rage. Luther has never had any great regard for Henry. From their very first dealings, he's considered Henry duplicitous and dishonest. And in many ways, he sees the execution of Barnes as the final proof of this, and more or less washes his hands and the University of Wittenberg's hands of any further dealings with Henry. He very quickly sees into print the transcript of the last words that Barnes spoke before he was burned. Somebody had copied them down. They circulated in England. They made it to Germany. They were translated into German. And Luther writes a nice little preface to that before it goes into print, where he famously refers to Barnes as Saint Robert. And despite all of his raging at Henry for being behind this, he ends on kind of a positive note, thanking God for the gift of martyrdom and for honoring his saints with a blessed death on behalf of the gospel.
He refers to him as our good, pious table companion and guest of our home, this holy martyr, Saint Robert. You mentioned that just a moment ago. It sounds as though Luther was willing to admit it, at the very least, that he had kind of a personal stake in how Robert Barnes' life ended.
I mean, there is some sense of that. That he recognizes that Barnes, for all of his love of England and all of his, in some ways, naive love of his king, he loved the gospel more, and Luther certainly recognizes that sentiment, and certainly Luther would have understood that a great deal of this love of the gospel came from his time in Wittenberg and his dealings with the reformers themselves.
How did the, in a more general sense, how did the Reformation as a movement react to the execution or the martyrdom of Robert Barnes?
In a variety of ways, this last speech of Barnes that gets translated into German, it goes through really an astonishing number of editions, both in England and in Germany and on the border of France. It's really quite astonishing how many people are reading this, especially in light of how obscure Robert Barnes is today. It has an interesting effect on the Reformation in England. Perhaps most obviously, it signals the end of any real concerted effort to reform the English Church along Lutheran lines. Barnes was unquestionably, along with Cromwell, the most emphatic supporter of that program. Archbishop Cranmer had been. He softens that a little bit in later years. In Germany, it has this effect on the Reformation. As I mentioned, it's the act which finally prompts Luther and Melanchthon to just wash their hands of England and say it's no longer worth our effort to try to help them along.
So would you say that you just said it closed the door on a Lutheran Reformation in England, made it essentially politically impossible to pursue that. Did it delay the English Reformation?
It delayed it in this sense, at least. The 1540 burning of Barnes is part of a much larger roundup of dissidents and so-called heretics and Protestants in London and around London. And although most of them are eventually released, this was a very clear indication that the state is taking seriously this Act of Six Articles, which clearly defines in law the theology of the Church of England and prohibits any debate of that theology. So this very public arresting of hundreds of people in 1540, the very public execution not only of Barnes, but of really the king's closest advisor, Cromwell, this sends a clear message that we will not debate and in some respects even discuss publicly any further movement in doctrine.
Finally, then, I'm fascinated by the nexus of political, theological, personal here. What can we all learn from the life and death of 16th century confessor and martyr Robert Barnes?
Well, if there's something that we can all learn, this will sound trite, but there's a famous phrase, ideas have consequences, or at least they do if you believe them firmly. You know, Barnes believed what he believed very firmly, even against all of the evidence that this belief was ever going to be adopted by his king or by his countrymen. And he did not, in the end, seem terribly concerned by that. The gospel was more important to him even than his own life.
Dr. Corey Moss is Associate Professor of Theology and Church History at Concordia University, California. Dr. Moss, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me again, Todd.
When we come back, Deaconess Pam Nielsen will join us. We're going to be talking about Dorcas, the mercy worker. That will take us to Acts chapter 9, if you'd like to follow along as we teach a Sunday school lesson for the next half hour of Issues, Etc. Speaking of history, and we love to bring as much of the church's history as we can to our listeners on a regular basis. One of the ways we're doing that through the month of July, which is quickly racing toward its end, is the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for July. It's called Faith and Act, The Survival of Medieval Ceremonies in the Lutheran Reformation. It is what it sounds like. It is a history, a rather detailed history, a really well-documented history of how the Lutheran Reformation proceeded with liturgical reform and, contrary to popular belief, did not throw out the baby with the bathwater or the liturgy with the ceremonies and the rites that they found abusive and erroneous in the previous Roman Catholic Church. They simply kept what they could. They kept everything that they could that still spoke clearly of the gospel. You can read more about it in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for July, Faith and Act, The Survival of Medieval Ceremonies in the Lutheran Reformation. Find out more at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order Faith and Act. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for July. When we come back, Deaconess Pam Nielsen will join us. We'll talk about Acts chapter 9, Dorcas, the mercy worker. We're joined now by listener Rocky. Rocky, tell us about the tax benefits of donating stocks to Issues, Etc.
What we discovered in talking with our tax people and our stock advisors is that it would be beneficial for us to be giving our charitable donations by this means, by giving stocks, which meant that we could give a stock and essentially say if you gave a $100 stock, it's straight money to whatever charitable organization you want to give, as opposed to cashing it out, we'd only be able to give whatever portion is left over after the tax consequences.
How would you advise our listeners if they're interested in donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds?
They need to go and talk to their stockbroker or their tax person, and I think they'll find out it makes a heck of a lot of economic sense. And you're much better steward with your money, because what you're ending up doing is stretching the dollars that you're able to give donation-wise, and you're able to give a whole lot more directly to those people that you want to support, and you're able to preserve much more for yourself using the laws that have been provided for it.
Rocky, is there anything that we left out that you want to tell our listeners?
Well, the only thing that you've missed is that people really need to support Issues, Etc. This is a terrific way to do it in a very economical way. It's a way to do it and be good stewards of the resources that God has blessed people with. And I would encourage everyone to support Issues, Etc. in every possible way that they can. And if this is available to them, I'd encourage them to look into it, because it not only will help them, but it'll help Issues, Etc. also.
To find out how to reduce your tax burden and support this worldwide outreach by donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds, talk to your stockbroker or tax advisor, and then call Craig here at Lutheran Public Radio, 618-223-8385.
Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
It's time for the Summer Olympics again. My wife and I really enjoy watching the sporting events unfold on TV. The world's finest athletes are competing against each other for the cherished gold, silver, and bronze. It's the culmination of a lifetime of training and sacrifice. But as we watch the Olympics, I'm reminded of those who are missing. How many gymnasts, swimmers, pole vaulters, and runners would have been present in London but were aborted? And how many parents will watch the competitions with an empty place in their hearts, wondering if their aborted babies would have grown up to be world-class athletes? Maybe God has one of those babies on his lap saying, "You would have taken silver in those low hurdles had your mom said yes to life." It's food for thought.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.